Across the Pacifica network and around the nation, this is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, August 22, 2003. From WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. While President Bush is touring the Northwest, he's also set to circumvent the congressional nominations process by making a recess appointment of Daniel Pipes to the Institute of Peace. Islamic groups call Pipes a racist. 100,000 people come out in Gaza City to mourn the assassination of Hamas leader Ismail Abu Shanab. And 40 years after Martin Luther King Jr. gave his I Have a Dream speech, a mass rally will be held to commemorate the March on Washington. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. United Nations officials are looking at the possibility that the bombers at their headquarters in Baghdad may have received help from the inside. Today, Secretary General Kofi Annan refused to respond to stories floating in the press, saying he had yet to receive a preliminary report. Yet other UN officials confirm that security at the hotel-turned-office was heightened in the days prior to the attack, countering claims that the UN refused offers to beef up security by the United States, but supporting the possibility of an inside job. The Indian government wants to extradite a U.S. CEO for his potential role in one of the worst environmental disasters, as members of their parliament want to further investigate charges against U.S. soft drink makers. Vinod K. Jose reports from Delhi.
India has forwarded an extradition request against former Union Carbide Chairman Warren Anderson to U.S. State and Justice Departments. The Minister of State for Chemicals, Dr. Chhatrapal Singh, told the Indian Parliament today. There were apprehensions that the Indian government was not keen on pursuing the case against the chief of Union Carbide in the world's worst industrial tragedy in Bhopal, India, in 1984. The minister asserted in a written reply that there was no move to end the case against Union Carbide. In another decision, the Indian government appointed a 15-member joint parliamentary committee to look into the controversy of pesticides in Coke and Pepsi. The committee will find out whether the recent findings of Delhi-based NGO Center for Science and Environment regarding pesticide residues in Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola and 10 other soft drink brands were correct or not. From New Delhi in India, I am Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
Argentina's Senate voted to abolish the nation's amnesty laws yesterday, designed to protect members of the former military government from prosecution of human rights abuses. Human rights groups report as many as 30,000 people were hunted down, kidnapped, tortured, and often executed from the years 1976 to 1983 in what has been dubbed the Dirty War. According to Dan Kershaw with the Buenos Aires Herald, actually prosecuting people may be a bit more difficult under Argentine law.
It's on a case-by-case basis. It doesn't have blanket application. So, for instance, let's say in the case of Videla, who was the head of the first junta, and the court decided the due obedience and final point law is unconstitutional, it would only apply to his case.
Kershaw says, ultimately, prosecutions will be up to the individual courts in the country. Five gun dealers and distributors agreed to a settlement yesterday in a lawsuit by a dozen California cities and counties that will change the way they do business in California. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports from Berkeley.
The settlement in a San Diego court marks the first time gun dealers have agreed to change their business practices in response to a lawsuit by cities and counties. A dozen California jurisdictions, including San Francisco and Los Angeles, say the gun industry's distribution system allowed juveniles and criminals to get guns. They accused two California gun dealers and three distributors of violating state law by failing to ensure guns weren't being sold to straw purchasers who deliver guns to arms traffickers. Under the settlement, the distributors agreed to stop selling arms at gun shows. The retail dealers agreed to take new steps to make it harder for guns to slip into the black market. Until now, the gun industry had been fairly successful in defending lawsuits in other parts of the country. Similar cases are pending in several cities. For Free Speech Radio News in Berkeley, I'm Christopher Martinez.
Tampa officials are dropping facial recognition software just 2 years after it became the nation's first city to use it in the search for undesirables on the streets. In Tampa, WMNF's Mitch Perry reports.
Officials from the Tampa Police Department announced earlier this week with little fanfare that they were dropping the use of the technology after admitting that in its 2 years of usage in Ybor City, Tampa's entertainment district, it had led to zero arrests. The software program, called FaceIt, was installed in 36 cameras in 2001, leading to protests by civil libertarians who considered the program invasive. The cameras would scan the faces of people who walked the streets, and then police officers in a separate location could scan those faces and run it through a criminal database to search for matches. Darlene Williams is chairperson for the Tampa branch of the ACLU.
Studies showed before they ever went through with this that this methodology was questionable at best.
Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
People poured out onto the streets of Gaza City today to mourn the assassination of Hamas leader Ismail Abu Shanab. Mohammed Halaini reports from the streets of the funeral in Gaza City.
This afternoon, at least 100,000 Palestinians from all walks of life and political affiliations crowded the streets of Gaza City to attend the funeral procession for Ismail Abu Shanab, a senior Hamas political leader, and his bodyguards Mu'min Barud and Hani Abu Al-Amrin. The three men were assassinated yesterday when an Israeli helicopter gunship fired 5 missiles at their car. An eyewitness at the scene described how the events unfolded before him.
The car was ablaze and people were afraid to go near it. We brought some fire extinguishers from the governor's building and tried to put the fire out to no avail. The fire brigade was too late to do anything.
When the three men were pulled out of the car, their bodies were charred and mangled almost beyond recognition. Ismail Abu Shanab was born in 1950 to a refugee family from a village inside the Israeli Green Line near Ashkelon. He studied civil engineering in Egypt and the US and held several professional and academic positions. He was also a founding member of Hamas and spent 8 years in Israeli prisons for participating and organizing acts of resistance in the first Palestinian uprising. Abu Shanab is remembered as one of the moderates in the Hamas political leadership. He played a pivotal role in securing the ceasefire announced by Hamas on June 30. Ironically, the ceasefire died with him. Dr. Abdelaziz Rantisi, a senior Hamas leader who survived an Israeli assassination attempt on June 10, spoke to Free Speech Radio News at the funeral.
We have canceled the truce. We will strike everywhere. Our solution is to direct earth-shattering blows at Israel. And if they want to solve this conflict, they should leave Palestine.
Israel has unwittingly unified the Palestinian people by assassinating Abu Shanab. The latest assassination preempted the Palestinian Authority crackdown against the military wings of Hamas and Islamic Jihad, a move that would have had severe implications on the internal Palestinian arena. As for the implications of assassinating a Hamas political leader on the security of the Israeli public, Dr. Rantisi told Free Speech Radio News,
"They are crazy. Ismail was dear to us. Therefore, the retaliation will be powerful. But Abu Hassan's death has strengthened the resistance. All of Gaza is chanting that the solution is to fight and resist."
Since the now-defunct unilateral ceasefire was announced on June 30, Palestinians have felt that the Israeli government have not in good faith preserved the ceasefire. Since the beginning of the ceasefire, the Israeli military has continued raids into Palestinian towns and has refused to dismantle checkpoints around the towns it withdrew from, like Bethlehem. Responding to Israeli violations, Palestinian Minister of Culture Ziyad Abu Amr told this reporter how Israeli authorities had undermined the ceasefire.
From its onset, Israel tried to sabotage the ceasefire by continuing assassinations, incursions, and killings. And when they refused a comprehensive prisoner release and refused a moratorium on settlement building, or the building of the apartheid separation wall, therefore Israel should bear full responsibility for the escalation and its implications.
The Abu Mazen government is still coming under pressure to act against Hamas and the other Palestinian resistance groups. This puts Abu Mazen between a rock and a hard place. If he acts against the Palestinian resistance factions, he risks turning the Palestinian street against him and will be forced out of office. Ziyad Abu Amr again.
This government will not stay in office for one day if it causes infighting or if it turns against the people.
Meanwhile, over the past 2 days, the Israeli army has invaded the Palestinian cities of Jenin, Nablus, and Tulkarem. 2 teenage brothers have been killed by the Israeli army in Tulkarem. Islam Ghanim was shot dead by the invading Israeli troops on Thursday morning, and his brother Saeed succumbed to his wounds today. Eyewitnesses reported that the boys were unarmed. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz is reporting on its website that the Israeli army has killed 3 Palestinians at the Refidia hospital in Nablus. Several hospital staff were also injured. President Bush has also announced the freezing of assets of top Hamas leaders and 5 non-governmental organizations, a move which, although it aims to cut the flow of cash for military operations, will probably have no effect on the Hamas military wing, since it is a common secret that the military wings of Hamas and other organizations rely on donations from its wide base of supporters in the occupied Palestinian territories. Such a freeze will probably have a more detrimental effect on Islamic charities in the Palestinian territories that rely on foreign funding. A Hamas website has indicated that the organization has no assets in foreign countries. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mohammed Ghalayini in Gaza.
Today, President Bush is set to circumvent the congressional nomination process by making a recess appointment of Mideast scholar Daniel Pipes to the Institute of Peace, a federally funded think tank for international peaceful conflict resolution. Earlier, Senate Democrats rejected the appointment after Islamic and civil rights groups touted Pipes as a racist. They say Pipes' support of racial profiling of Arabs as possible terrorists makes him unfit for the Institute. But under the law, Bush could make the appointment without Senate confirmation because Congress is at recess and won't return to the Capitol until September. This will allow Pipes to serve for the next 18 months. Mitch Jeserich has more from Capitol Hill.
Daniel Pipes is the founder and former director of the Middle East Forum, a think tank to promote American interests throughout Western Asia. He has taught Middle East issues at several universities, and he is the author of several books on Islam. He also runs a website that posts English translations of Arabic news, and he told C-SPAN that the best way to deal with terrorism is through military might.
There's extreme anti-Westernism, anti-Americanism among Muslims, be it Saddam Hussein or Al-Qaeda or Hamas or Hezbollah. These are all extreme groups that engage in violence against us, and we must crush them.
It appears President Bush is sidestepping Congress on Friday by appointing Pipes to the Institute of Peace while legislators are in recess. The U.S. Senate already blocked Pipes' nomination after Muslim and civil rights groups protested, calling Pipes' support of racial profiling of Arab Americans as possible terrorists appalling and racist. Ibrahim Hooper with the Council on American Islamic Relations, also known as CARE, says Pipes' advocacy of the military conquest over parts of the Middle East makes him unfit for the Institute of Peace.
The idea of peacemaking is the utter destruction of one's enemies, whether it's in the Middle East or anywhere else in the world. And I don't think that is a viewpoint that will benefit the Institute of Peace.
President Bush's push of the Pipes nomination through has caught the attention of the Muslim world, partly due to coverage by Al Jazeera. Hooper says that the president's appointment further militates the hope that the Bush administration could build closer ties to the people of the Middle East.
I think the president needs all the allies he can get in the Muslim and Arab worlds, and this appointment would be a stumbling block for any ally of the United States. It would seem to confirm the suspicions of those who say that the war on Islam is, or the war on terrorism is an attack on Islam. It reinforces that perception in certain quarters. And I think that's the last thing we need at this point. The appointment would harm America's interests and image worldwide.
On his website, Pipes defends his reputation by saying he is against radical Islam and he feels that moderate Islam is the best hope for peace. He also attacks the Council on American Islamic Relations by saying, quote, "It apologizes for killers such as Hamas and helps promote terrorism." Pro-Israeli groups support Pipes' appointment. Josh Block is a spokesperson for America's pro-Israel lobby.
I don't agree with everything Dan Pipes says, but I think he does speak to a very important perspective, which is the need for moderate voices within Islam to stand up and help transform a society that inculcates intolerance and hatred among its children and most vulnerable beginning at their very earliest ages. And continuing through school, to the mosque, all throughout life.
Most American Islamic and peace groups agree the Institute of Peace is an obscure think tank with little influence. So then why the fuss? Ibrahim Hooper says that President Bush's appointment of Daniel Pipes is part of a larger effort of neoconservatives suppressing Muslim influence in society. Daniel Pipes will serve on the Institute of Peace for at least the next 18 months. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Cheserich in Washington.
The current leg of President Bush's re-election fundraising tour brings him to the northwestern United States, where he's also making stops to promote his Healthy Forest Initiative. We begin our coverage of the president's tour with Martha Baskin in Seattle.
President Bush's visit to the Northwest is meeting resistance on a number of fronts. In the Tri-Cities, protesters are assailing his salmon restoration record. In Seattle, activists are confronting the administration's jobs, environmental, and Iraq record during numerous rallies scheduled over the next several days. Department of Defense naval shipyard workers were originally granted a permit to protest in front of the McCaw Mansion, where telecom giant Craig McCaw is hosting a $2,000 a plate fundraiser. But yesterday, the permit was pulled by the Secret Service, effectively preventing TV cameras from seeing the protesters who were pushed back to another location. Mike Goddard with the International Association of Machinists.
This is absolutely indicative of this administration. They find out what our message is and they cancel our permit. And there's no reason that they pulled that other than to manipulate the media.
The workers' beef with Bush centers around measures within the Department of Defense called the Rumsfeld Personnel Transformation Act that strip workers of their right to union representation and nepotism protection laws. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin in Seattle.
Meanwhile, in Portland, Oregon, Bush's motorcade drove to a fundraiser past fences which had been erected to keep back the over 2,000 protesters gathered to let the president know that the American public does not approve of his agenda. Andrew Stelzer reports from Portland.
Bush, go home! Bush, go home!
1 year ago, on August 22nd, the president came to Portland to raise money for Republican Senator Gordon Smith. About 1,400 protesters showed up to greet Bush. Police panicked and pepper sprayed many people, including babies. This year, despite concerns that the police would again act inappropriately, over 2,000 people converged to sing, dance, chant, and express their discontent with Bush and his agenda on issues ranging from the U.S. invasion of Iraq to recent attacks on gay rights. Tom Hastings is a professor at Portland State University.
You've got people here representing either the direct victims or stand-ins speaking for the victims, all the way from old-growth forests to workers, and everybody in between and everybody who lives in other countries or in the bomb sites here today.
Bush himself never came in sight of the thousands of protesters who filled the street that had been fenced off the night before. They did see his motorcade roll by. Tory Scott and Ernest Jones were among the people who decided to exercise their right to political expression.
Actually, I don't really like being at anti-protests, but I just feel compelled to because I think Bush is wreaking such havoc on the country.
The people he brings on as well, like John Ashcroft, I think are really dangerous and have been very harmful to our society.
After the luncheon, Bush flew to Southern Oregon to promote his Healthy Forests Initiative. He flew over forest fires, which he described as a holocaust. Serena from the Cascadia Forest Alliance says Bush's plan is misguided and is simply an excuse to cut down ancient forests and build more roads.
The Healthy Forest Initiative is basically Bush's way of saying there's a big scary thing known as fire. It's scary. I'm not going to tell you why it's scary, but it's scary. Therefore, we need to cut down all the forests.
The protesters did find an opportunity to express their discontent with the mainstream media, surrounding a reporter from the local ABC station while she tried to file a live report, chanting corporate media lies and blocking the camera. Overall, the day was peaceful until after the president left, and a couple hundred protesters returned to the neighborhood park where the march began. About 30 people stood in the street and blocked a bus full of people who had attended Bush's $2,000 a plate fundraiser. Riot police made at least 10 arrests and used pepper spray to clear the park. The security costs to the financially strapped city of Portland were estimated in the hundreds of thousands. Portland's mayor has suggested she may try to build a Bush campaign. For Free Speech Radio News from Portland, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
Months after President Bush's May declaration of the end of, quote, major combat in Iraq, at least two more U.S. servicemen were killed in the last 24 hours, bringing the U.S. military death toll since May to 65, with a total of 196 troops killed since the U.S. launched its attack against Iraq in March, this according to Reuters. And as troops continue to die in what military analysts predict will be a long and drawn-out guerrilla war, family members of US troops are increasingly vocal about bringing their loved ones back home. In solidarity with these efforts, former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney spoke earlier this week at the House of Lords Church in Brooklyn, New York, along with family members of U.S. servicemen and women, labor leaders, and progressive politicians to call for an end to the U.S. occupation of Iraq. From Pacifica Station WBAI in New York, Jackson Allers reports.
The event billed as a kickoff for a national Bring the Troops Home Now campaign highlighted the increasing number of family members of U.S. troops speaking out against the continued military involvement in Iraq. Gloria Jackson has a daughter serving in Iraq. Jackson's daughter is among those who joined the military ranks out of what was perceived as an economic opportunity.
I feel very bad because I suggested that she go in because I couldn't afford to send her to college.
According to Jackson, her daughter is scheduled to come back to the U.S. by September 4th, but recent orders indicate she will have to stay in Iraq until she finds her replacement. Jackson is distraught at the reports her daughter is sending back home.
They say the war is over. I can't say exactly what she said to me, but she says it's not really over. If you could just see what's going on. I can't, you know, if I could just tell you everything that she says to me, I wish I could, but I want her home.
Larry Holmes, an organizer of the evening and a spokesperson for ANSWER, Act Now to Stop War and End Racism, says the Pentagon and the Bush administration misled the U.S. troops into thinking Operation Iraqi Freedom would be a quick military engagement.
It's in their own words. They write the letters and the emails home. We've been lied to. And they told they were coming home right away. Find out they're staying there 6 months or longer. They were told they would not be shot at. Yet they're dying every day.
And as casualties mount, GI support groups like SNAFU, the Support Network for an Armed Forces Union, are fielding an increasing amount of questions from U.S. troops serving in Iraq, asking how to obtain discharges and how to organize anti-war activities on their bases or ships. New York civil rights attorney Ron Kuby also spoke at the event. Kuby and others emphasized the Pentagon's effort to stifle dissent among military families.
When the families speak up against the war because they want their sons and daughters back, the military sends out circulars saying, don't speak in public, because to do that will embolden the Saddam Fedayeen.
Former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney of Georgia was the featured speaker of the night. McKinney questioned how powerful Washington insiders like Bush, Cheney, Powell, and Rice are allowed to send the poor and people of color to their deaths for what she calls the cannon fodder for Bush's new American century.
Caspar Weinberger suggests that America's people of color are more patriotic than America's young white kids are, and that's why the military is disproportionately more people of color in our all-volunteer military.
Reporting in New York City for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jackson Allers.
A senior State Department official told reporters today that the Bush administration is not willing to offer incentives or inducements to North Korea to end its nuclear program as part of six-way peace talks in Beijing next week. Peace activists, though, have long criticized the United States for failing to live up to commitments to help North Korea develop nuclear power that was part of a settlement brokered by Jimmy Carter in 1994. Meanwhile, in South Korea, Nok Win and Aaron Glantz report that a community is in uproar over that country's plans for its nuclear waste.
Thousands of protesters crowd in front of City Hall in Pohang. Some throw garbage and rotten food at riot police. They're here to protest a proposal to build South Korea's first nuclear waste dump on Wido Island, just 10 miles away. Residents of Pohang, mostly fishermen and farmers, have demonstrated for 29 days straight. Some of the protests drew tens of thousands. Protests have taken place in other cities in the province. Gwangpo is a fishing village where vacationers often catch a ferry to Wido. Fishermen line up their boats at the dock to unload the morning's catch. The men use nets to transfer the fish to mesh bags, but then go to the market and local restaurants. a local fisherman who preferred not to give his name, joined others the day before in a 600-boat demonstration, shutting down 13 ports along the coast.
The government said they will build a nuclear waste dump in 2008, but who wants to come here to eat the fish or eat the rice if we have a nuclear waste dump and if you see a ship right next to the watermelon? Maybe you don't want to eat the watermelon. It's the same thing. No tourists will want to come here.
Speaking on Korean television this week, President No Mu-yeong said he wanted to have a dialogue with Wido and other residents affected by the decision, but he said whatever the dialogue, the dump will go ahead as planned. 47-year-old chili farmer Sin Young-sun also rents small bungalows to tourists. He has a wife and a baby girl and also cares for his elderly mother and aunt. If the dump goes ahead as planned, his house will be demolished and the land will become home to radioactive waste.
Several fishermen, they have agreed with having the nuclear waste dump here because they think they can get some compensation because of their job. But I think they should think twice about doing that because the government will not compensate them.
After three generations, Sun says he plans to move his family away from the island to the capital of the province. He says he won't be able to buy another house because the compensation won't be big enough. And he wonders what he will do to make a living. Just 1,500 people live on Wido. The rugged hills of the island are covered with thick woods of pine trees. Vast beaches stretch out around its coast. Once the waste is buried underground, it will remain radioactive for 35,000 years. The country already has 18 nuclear reactors, 6 are under construction, and 2 more are planned. Political leaders say it is the only way for Korea to be self-sufficient since it doesn't have any oil, gas, or coal deposits. But locals say that's short-sighted. Yun Chan Han is 15 years old. She organized tonight's demonstration.
The other people from other areas, they can't think we are greedy because they don't live here. It's all about the right to existence. We don't have enough land in Korea. They will build more nuclear power plants if they build the dump.
Please come during vacation. She and her friends sing a song they wrote. Please come and eat raw fish. Pohon shouldn't have a nuclear waste dump. A clean Pohon is a real Pohon. Tens of thousands of protesters are expected in the provincial capital tomorrow, the 30th straight day of demonstrations. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nok Wen with Aaron Glantz on Wido Island in South Korea.
This weekend marks the 40th anniversary of the historic March on Washington back in 1963, and tomorrow thousands will converge on the Capitol in a mass demonstration. The Reverend James Lawson, a longtime associate of Martin Luther King Jr., says the dreams that Dr. King told the world he had 40 years ago are far from realized today.
No, if Dr. King were alive, he would know that, in fact, the American dream is become even more for millions of people a nightmare. Black unemployment levels are still double-digit, the national levels. Racism is more pervasive today than has ever been in my lifetime. We have over 2 million people in jails, prisons, right now.
What do you think Dr. King would be doing today if he was still a leader, especially at a time when civil rights are so under attack? What would Dr. King be telling the people?
We must resist the status quo. We must resist the Bush administration. We must resist its racism, its violence, its sexism, its power addictions, its militarization, its greed. We must mobilize ourselves. We must gather our neighbors, organize, mobilize, develop nonviolent actions and strategies, and wage a relentless struggle.
The Reverend James Lawson, a longtime associate of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. You've been listening to FSRN. I'm Deepa Fernandez.